Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Coffee and Crime, a true crime podcast. If it's your first time tuning in, hi, hello, how you doing? My name is Lisa Marie, and each week I sit down with a cup of coffee and I tell you all a true crime story. Now, this week is the third part of a four-part mini-series called Deadly Daughters. You would have seen that in the episode's title. For the last couple of weeks, we've covered cases of daughters who have taken matters into their own hands when it comes to the fate of their family members. Part one was about Erin Caffey, part two was about Esme Singh, and now this is our third part. Obviously, you don't have to listen to part one and part two, but I highly recommend it because if you stick around to the end of this week's episode, we're going to play a little game with the cases covered so far in the series to see if you can guess who our fourth and final deadly daughter is next week. Ooh. So the podcast spotlight for this week is, oh, my heart. It's these two girls who host an unbelievably entertaining podcast. I am in awe of their research and their delivery on cases, their charisma, their relationship with one another. It's just a perfect mix. But I'm not going to introduce them to you. What? I know, right? I am not going to gatekeep them. Instead, I'm actually going to let them introduce themselves to you. So, lovely listeners, here is the amazing Abby and Ali from About Time for True Crime.
I'm Abby.
And I'm Ali.
And we are
About Time for True Crime
podcast.
Hey, and welcome to our True Crime podcast. We are so happy that you are tuning in. We are a couple of professionals working in the criminal justice field, although, you know, our views do not reflect our workplace, girl. But we also happen to be best friends, so that kind of works out.
That we do, and that it does. And together, we have over a decade of education in the field, focusing on criminal justice, pre-law, psychology. We also hold licenses in working with individuals struggling with substance use disorder, where there is a major crossover of mental health concerns and the criminal justice system and all of that jazz.
So not only do we tackle these cases with that background, but we discuss true crime cases and offer our perspectives. Given our education, experience in the field, and hours of research, we really try to help you see how we walk through these cases and what our different perspectives might bring to the way we see it. We discuss true crime cases that are known far and wide, and also cases that are hardly discussed. We try to put ourselves in the places of all involved to gain an understanding of what the events must have looked like and felt like to be there.
We discuss cases providing objective facts about what happened in the case, but without withholding our compassion and our empathy. And at least for us, our coping mechanism is definitely humor, and we will not ever hesitate to make a joke at an offender's expense. And let's be honest, usually not PG.
Yeah, rarely to never PG, particularly on the offender expense.
Of course.
But that being said, we also have episodes on criminal justice special topics and how they relate to true crime cases. For example, we've covered the different ways that people with disabilities are victimized, the characteristics of female serial killers, and even organized versus disorganized serial killers.
At its core, this podcast is really just a recording of the conversations that we're having anyway. We're a couple of criminal justice nerds who spend a lot of free time researching some of the most depraved and horrific crimes in the world, and we just want to tell each other about it.
We love all of the heinous things here. We also love interacting with you guys, our listeners, and we will always take listener requests for cases and topics to cover, and you bet your booty we will respond to anything that we can.
Of course. And really, we just hope that you consider hanging out with us in our little corner of the true crime world. And if I check my watch, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
See you guys there.
Oh, aren't they great? I absolutely love them. They're a fantastic podcast. So please go and show Abby and Ali some love. Thank you guys for being a part of today's episode. It means a lot to me, and I just love hearing your voices. So thank you so much for that. All right, shall we crack into this week's case? It is a bit of a doozy. Emotions will run high, I can tell you that now. So, lovely listeners of Coffee and Crime, grab your cup of coffee or whatever caffeinated beverage you need to get through your day as I tell you about the murder of Anne Margaret Levenstein Carubin. Warning, the following episode contains adult language, discussion on excessive alcohol and drug use, domestic violence, suicide ideation, and murder that listeners may find disturbing. This podcast is recommended for listeners 16 years and above. Listener discretion is advised. So, if you saw my Tuesday teaser post on Instagram about this week's case, the caption stated how I couldn't actually say much about the case. That was a little bit of clickbait, I do apologize. The reason I said that is because the people involved in this case actually fall under the Canadian Youth Protection Act, subject to subsection 110, the identity of the offender not be published, 111, the identity of the victim or witness not be published, and 129, no subsequent disclosure is guilty of an indictable offence and liable to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 2 years. So if you are in Canada, you cannot publish or speak the name of those involved in this crime. I am in New Zealand, so they don't apply to me, but I did hit an ethical conundrum about this. I know the real names of those involved, and I've read things that were published outside of Canada where the Protection Act doesn't apply. But does that mean I should use their names? After quite the internal battle about this, I have decided I am going to use their real names. The reason I've come to this conclusion is because I believe it pays a tremendous amount of respect to our victim, making her name, her life, and her death, her story heard. Names hold a lot of power, in my opinion, and I want to give our victim some power back, as hers was taken away. Also, I want to call the murderers out because I do not like them and I feel that people need to know what they did and I don't believe they should be protected because they are still to this day protected and no one in Canada is supposed to know who they are. So, anyway, let's get into it. We're going to start our story today talking about Anne Margaret Levenstein, who was born on the 5th of April 1959 in Bialystok, Poland. Now, her parents were both medical doctors and the family were reasonably wealthy. After Anne Margaret finished high school, she decided to go to university. She wasn't there for long though, because during her studies, she met and married a man named Walter Carubin and she ended up not finishing her degree. Now, sometime during the 1980s, Anne Margaret and Walter immigrated to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan in Canada for Walter to continue his education. I just wanted to read past those names really quickly because I was freaking out. I was going to say the wrong. Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. I hope I said them right. I just look at those, like the spelling, and I think Sacagawea from Night at the Museum. Anyway. So they're in Saskatoon while just completing his education, and in 1987, the couple welcomed their first daughter, Caroline Carubin. Then, once Walter was finished with his studies, the family of three moved 30 hours away to the suburb of Etobicoke in Toronto, Ontario. Oh, Canada, you guys are challenging me. In Etobicoke, this is where they became a family of four. In 1988, Catherine Carubin was born. So the girls were only about a year apart, meaning Anne Margaret got pregnant real quick after Caroline. However, it wasn't all happy families. When Caroline and Catherine were about 4 and 3 years old, Walter and Anne Margaret divorced. Now, according to Catherine, the youngest, she remembered her father being very emotionally rigid. He acted as if he still lived in Poland and wasn't overly accepting of their new life in Canada. Walter and Anne Margaret fought all the time and it was just not a happy household. And after they split, they continued to argue over the access to Caroline and Catherine, and unfortunately the girls were used as weapons by both parents against each other. Anne Margaret tried to stop Walter from seeing his daughters because he had a little bit of a quick temper. So Walter would purposefully take low-paying jobs so that he was under the threshold to pay a decent amount of child support until he got regular visits with his daughters. Even though he was an educated man, he would just be very petty and get shit jobs. There was a toxic, non-existing co-parenting relationship going on here, and unfortunately the girls were caught in the middle. It got so bad between Anne Margaret and Walter that Caroline and Catherine were sent back to Poland to live with their maternal grandmother for 2 years while their parents sorted their shit out. Like, it was so bad they had to leave the freaking country. That's insane. Now, while her daughters were in Poland, Anne Margaret took the opportunity to go back to university and complete her degree. As I said before, she didn't due to marrying Walter, moving to Canada and having their family. So she also did this to be sure that she could get a good paying job to be able to financially support her daughters, since she couldn't rely on Walter to do that because of their arguing, because of the animosity. She just wanted to make sure she had a job. That's fair enough. Walter seemingly backed off in a way. It was just not good on all fronts. So Anne Margaret did complete her education and graduated with a nursing degree and got a job at a local hospital. And when this happened, Caroline and Catherine moved back from Poland to be with her. They moved from their apartment in Etobicoke to 15 minutes away into a townhouse in Mississauga. And I want to say a big thank you to Erica from Story Crime Podcast for that pronunciation, because I was thinking it was like Mississauga. Mississauga. No, Mississauga. I still feel like I'm saying that wrong. Now, even though Walter backed off, he didn't completely wash his hands of the girls. He seemed more or less only interested in their academic achievements. So any award ceremonies they had during school that they were going to receive a certificate at, he would be there. He would then also take them out for dinner afterwards and get an ice cream. But because of the animosity with Anne Margaret, he remained pretty distant with every other aspect in their lives. Now, what's interesting, Catherine, the youngest, she remembered how her father was before her parents split, right? We just spoke about that. However, she barely remembers the times they spent together after her parents split, even though she would have been 2 years older. I find this very interesting. Whereas, like, Caroline, she does remember, you know, the visits with Walter, and she remembers them fondly. But Catherine seemed to block them out. Walter was pretty much a loner. He kept to himself, described as a bit odd, but I think he was quite academic focused in life, and he would much rather just sit by himself and read a good book about maths. You know what I mean? Like, that's just kind of what I'm getting from him. And because he wasn't really a people person, he didn't know how to co-parent healthily with Anne Margaret, because he wasn't a people person. So we are going to do a little bit of a backtrack. While the girls were in Poland, in 1991, Anne Margaret ran into an old friend of hers who had immigrated to Canada from Poland as well, and he would go on to become her common law husband, and his name was Doug. Now, we have talked about common law spouses on this podcast before, but just as a little reminder, a common law spouse is someone who you are by all means married to, but you just didn't have a wedding or anything official on paper, but you share finances, you share a house, assets, a child, all that type of thing. So when the girls came back from Poland, Doug was only Anne Margaret's boyfriend at the time, but then in 1997, when Caroline was 10 and Catherine was 9, Doug and Anne Margaret welcomed their son Robert, or Bobby, to the world. And so, like I just said, sharing a child also comes into play with common law spouses. So they are now a somewhat blended family of five. Caroline and Catherine adored Bobby and were happy to have a little brother, but they just hated Doug. And to be honest, so do I. Doug was an a-hole to the highest degree. He was abusive verbally and physically. During arguments, he would hit Anne Margaret, and unfortunately, he would hit Caroline and Catherine if they tried to help their mum. Anne Margaret developed a drinking habit, which it did actually start after her split with Walter, but just got a whole lot worse when she was with Doug. He was also a heavy drinker, so they would just set each other off in drunken rages, which would turn incredibly violent on Doug's behalf. And this continued for years. In 2001, after being in a relationship with one another for 10 years, Anne Margaret and Doug finally split after a particularly bad argument, which resulted in police showing up to the property, and Doug was convicted of an assault with a weapon. However, by the time that Doug was out of the picture, Anne Margaret was only living to find her next drink. Unfortunately, she was self-medicating heavily with alcohol, and there were very few articles I read, like very few resources that I kind of take this with a grain of salt, but they said that she was also possibly using crack cocaine. Anne Margaret at this point was so depressed. She was also a single mother to three kids, trying to feed them and look after them while trying to look after herself, because her mental health has just taken a huge plummet. She's the victim of a domestic violence relationship. It's just not a good time for anyone. Caroline and Catherine really stepped up to help Anne Margaret, their mother, especially when it came to looking after little Bobby. But dinners became more of a special occasion rather than an everyday occurrence. Anne Margaret was driving the kids to and from school drunk, using money that she earned for her next fix first and family necessities after. She paid, you know, kind of the bills, like the mortgage on the house or the rent or whatever she was doing, anything to keep them in the house first, and then her alcohol, and then whatever the family needed after that. Now, you may have just thought, well, I hope she still isn't a nurse at this point. Anne Margaret is who you would call a high-functioning alcoholic. She was able to pull her shit together when she needed to in front of the public. So by all accounts, or lack of accounts saying otherwise, she was still a nurse. Not only did she work long hours as a nurse, but she did also pick up a second job just to keep income within the family. Now, I just want to say, even though Anne Margaret wasn't being a perfect mum, and there is no perfect mum, but obviously with the behaviours she is exhibiting, yes, she's drinking, self-medicating. I get that it's easy to look at that and shame her as a mother, but she was abused. She was left by two men who gave her nothing but trouble, and Anne Margaret was a human who unfortunately was dealt a bad hand. Let's just remember that. Like, I don't excuse her behavior, like driving intoxicated with kids in the car. That's not okay. But I respect that she didn't give up trying to get money and held down not one, but two jobs. You know, she had a job to do and her mental health was pretty much non-existent at this point, and she is still trying to do the damn thing and work, which can't be said for a lot of people who suffer a lot less than Anne Margaret did. Now, like I said, Caroline and Catherine did try their best to help their mother any way they could, but they are also two young girls. They're trying to figure themselves out, trying to navigate school and the social challenges that come with that. They're going through puberty and having to go through physical changes and hormonal imbalances and all that good stuff that being a teenager entails. So they knew that they needed help. And on two occasions, the girls actually called Children's Aid Society to report their situation to try and get their mother some help. They talked to family members and their father, Walter, about what was going on. But every time anyone came to see them and Anne Margaret, she would put her game face on and show them that everything's fine. I have a couple of glasses of wine at night after a long day. That's all it is. You know, that's the kind of front she was putting up. She was too proud to receive help and felt as though she would have been considered a failure if people realized how deep in her depression she was, which is heartbreaking that she felt this way and couldn't get help for her and her family. Now, the investigation from Children's Aid Society did not support society intervention. The first call that the girls made, they actually recounted their statement, and I'm not sure why, but the second investigation was closed after Anne Margaret appeared to be well. She had a steady income, they had a house, a bed, there was some food in there. It just didn't meet the criteria for social intervention. And again, like, this is just so sad. It's not shameful to ask for help. It actually shows strength that you can put your pride on the shelf and say, yes, I am struggling, please help me. And that is so much more courageous than trying to keep everything on your own shoulders. And like, I'm sitting there saying this, I'm guilty of this. And I know a lot of people are, because you don't want to feel like a burden to other people and you don't want people knowing your dirty laundry and all that kind of stuff. But honestly, it's something that I need to work on. But it is a lot better to ask for help than to sink deeper and deeper. And unfortunately, Anne Margaret didn't know this or didn't realize this or didn't want to accept this. What also played into Anne Margaret not being suspected of being a below average mother, if you will, is the fact that her co-workers thought she was brilliant. She was a hard worker, she was selfless, and she spoke really highly of her family, especially her daughters, and her co-workers spoke highly of her. She had no disciplinary meetings, no enemies at work, no nothing. Now, of course, they didn't see her having a drinking problem, but there were some colleagues who thought that she might have a bit of an absent problem since she was working long hours, she was working multiple jobs, so they did see that she wasn't around her children a lot. But to everyone who knew her, she was a hard-working single mother to three children. One child being a four-year-old boy who can be difficult on its own, but then add two teenage girls, like, that's the worst. Not dealing with one new menstrual cycle, but two. I swear I've got a bottle of vodka ready to be opened when my daughter gets her first period, because no, thank you. No. Depression and alcoholism is obviously not something to joke about. Well, what I'm trying to do here is show you all that Anne Margaret is not a bad person. She's just trying to get on in the pretty shit world that she had. Speaking of two menstrual cycles, Caroline and Catherine were at the bitchy stage, shall we say, in their puberty journey. At school with their peers, all they wanted was everything their friends had, which I totally get. This is very normal behavior. Grass is always greener on the other side. They saw their friends getting new things regularly, being able to go out to dinners, have birthday parties, go to the movies, be able to do normal teenage stuff, which unfortunately Caroline and Catherine weren't able to do as much because of Anne Margaret's alcohol issues and mental health issues, and also looking after Bobby, you know, helping looking after their little brother. So it wasn't fair on Caroline and Catherine to deal with that whatsoever. And with this responsibility at such a young age, it turned onto full-on resentment towards Anne Margaret, their mother, and they didn't keep this hidden. Caroline and Catherine had the same group of friends at school since they were so close in age and were dealing with the same things at home. They were just always together and obviously could confide in one another about how they were feeling about what they were dealing with at home. But the girls would bitch about their mum to their friends. And again, I get this. This is normal. But when I bitched about my mum, sorry mum, if you listen, I bitched about you. When I bitched about my mum, it was more like, oh, my mum took my phone off me before I went to bed, so I couldn't text you back. You know, like, menial little things. Whereas Caroline and Catherine would say, like, oh, mum's always drinking and she's never around, and when she's at home, she's just asleep all the time. Which, obviously, is a true thing to say, but they leave out the fact that she's never around because she's working two jobs. She's asleep all the time because she's exhausted from working two jobs and being a single mum to three kids. Anne Margaret wasn't perfect, but she wasn't completely useless. But again, it's normal teenage behaviour to bitch about your parents. But they would also bitch about not having a house with a pool in the yard. Like, what? The girls lived in a beautiful two-story townhouse. Not a trailer, not an apartment that was too small and they had to sleep on the couch. No, they had a modest home, a bed each. They had clothes, they had supplies for school. They didn't look rich, and they certainly weren't, but they definitely didn't look poor either. So a little bit of entitled behavior was starting to go on. And I mean, Anne Margaret's family back in Poland were reasonably wealthy, if you remember back from the start. So for their birthdays and for Christmas, they were both given beautiful presents and gorgeous clothes from their Polish relatives. So they weren't without, you know, they actually weren't without. So even though they had a lot to deal with and rightfully so, they had reasons to be pissed off with their mum. It's not like they were going to school in holy, dirty clothes, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to brush off or diminish what they're experiencing and what they're going through. I do empathize with their situation and feel sorry for them, but they were more or less complaining about not having lavish things that most families didn't have anyway. I've never had a house with a pool in the yard. My parents never had. My grandparents never had. So I could probably say I know zero people who have a house with a pool in the yard. Like, it's not something that every family has. And now they're complaining about that. They obviously couldn't see the bigger picture because of their age, which is understandable, but I'm not a big fan of these girls, which is why I'm kind of like, sit down, shut up. Yes, you have got a lot to deal with. No one is saying that you don't. And that's terrible. That's awful for, you know, 13, 14 year old girls. That is a lot to handle. But complain about that, not the fact that you don't have a Gucci bag or a Louis Vuitton. I don't even know because I don't do high branded clothing. Complain about the real issues in life and not the fact that you don't have a fucking house with a pool in the yard. Just now, throughout the summer of 2002, things were not looking any better for the family. And Margaret started missing work from being exhausted and unfortunately intoxicated. And the hospital caught on that she was drinking all the time and she was let go from her nursing job. And I mean, it's probably for the best at this point because her drinking was not slowing down. And until she was not drinking, it was probably for the, you know, probably the best for the patients in the hospital. But with the loss of her job meant that there definitely was no spare money in the household, and Anne Margaret was sinking deeper and deeper into her depression. Some reports said that Anne Marie also began another relationship at this point. There wasn't heaps on it, but they were saying that she was trying to make this relationship move quite quickly and get her new boyfriend to marry her. But he wasn't keen on that just yet. He's like, whoa, slow down, Nelly. Like, which, again, that makes sense. But it made Anne Margaret feel worse about herself, you know, that she's not marriage material, and about her situation. Like, if he can't marry me and won't marry me, like, no one's going to be there for me and I'm all alone. And, it just made her feel so much worse and that she couldn't catch a break. Caroline and Catherine were at their wits' end, and they also started following the same dark path their mother was on. They started skipping school regularly, they started going to parties, using alcohol and drugs to forget their problems at home, and it wasn't too long after that they started engaging in sexual activity, and they were just ready to wash their hands of their mother at this point. But then the unimaginable happened. On January 18th, 2003, at around 10:30 p.m., a 911 call came in with a very distraught Caroline on the phone telling the dispatcher that she thinks her mum is dead in their bathtub. The dispatcher asked Caroline to check her pulse or pull her out of the bath and start performing CPR and that she'll be walked through it, but Caroline didn't want to touch the body and didn't think she could physically pull her mum out of the tub anyway. Within minutes, Peel Regional Police Constable Blair Horner was first to the residence to find 16-year-old Caroline and 15-year-old Catherine in their home crying. He went upstairs to find Anne Margaret, who was only 43 years old at the time of her death, lying face down in the bath. Even though she was warm to the touch because of the bathwater, rigor mortis had already set in and her skin was turning grey. As first responders showed up to the scene, Constable Horner sat down with the two girls to get their particulars and a timeline of events for that night. The girls told Constable Horner that earlier in the evening they had planned to go to dinner with their friends, so Anne Margaret gave them her credit card. They met their friend at the bus stop around 6:30 p.m. and went to Jack Astor's for dinner. They returned home around 10:30 p.m. and found their mother in the bathtub. Caroline told Constable Horner all about Anne Margaret's battle with depression and alcoholism, and that when the girls left, their mother was visibly intoxicated, but since her alcohol intake had been an ongoing issue for so long, the girls didn't think that this night would be any different to any other Saturday night, so they left without a second thought. The officers processing the scene noted that it was unusual for an adult to drown in a bathtub. The most common age for drowning in a bath is between 1 and 4 years old, and then 5 to 9 years old. For a full-grown adult, it's very rare because adrenaline kicks in, fight or flight kicks in. It's impossible to drown yourself without weighted assistance. I know this is horrible to say, but you can't just put your head down in the bath and drown yourself. You know, you need something keeping you down, something that stops you getting up, because your body, it's unbelievable, your body will make sure that you get out of the water. You can't stop that. It's going to happen. Plus, the size of an adult compared to most standard bathtubs makes it easy to stop yourself drowning by being able to pull yourself out of the water. And Anne Margaret's right arm was slumped over the side. So this was kind of a red flag for them. They're like, well, that's odd. Her hand was out. She could have pulled herself up. Police also noticed that her head was down at the same end as the taps, the faucets, which, to me, this is another red flag. When I get into a bath, my feet are by the taps because, one, I don't want to bump my head on these metal taps that one of them is hot and one of them is very cold. But two, I will use my feet to turn on the taps if I need more hot water. I know I'm not the only person who does that. Do not sit there and go, ooh, gross. I know you've done it. Get off your high horse. We've all been there. However, with no sign of struggle in the bathroom or anywhere else in the house, there was no reason to be suspicious of any foul play. If there were any trauma, bruises, or fingerprints on Anne Margaret's body, they would all be revealed in the autopsy. Caroline and Catherine were taken down to the station for further questioning while Anne Margaret's body was taken for the autopsy. Now, the girls seemingly calmed down a little bit after being taken out of the house for some fresh air and a bit of distance. That did seem to help. Caroline was still really upset, but not hysterically, while Catherine was calm, but she was quiet and sad looking. Now, this doesn't say much for me. You don't know how you'd react to the situation unless you've been in it. You could be lying on the floor, rolling around, screaming and punching everything and, you know, tearing up everything. Or you could be so still and quiet because of the shock. I very fortunately still have my mother around, and I hope to for a very long time, so I don't even know how I'd react in this situation. Now, down at the station, again, the girls gave their formal statements about their evening plans and what happened. They also went into further detail about their life with an alcoholic for a mum and how this was a regular occurrence and how it got worse after their dad left and then after her abusive relationship with Doug, and then she lost her job and then this happened, and they told them the whole story, their version of the story. So let's talk about Anne Margaret's autopsy. This confirmed that there was no trauma to her body, no bruising, no fingerprints, no wounds or cuts or anything suspicious on the outside. On the inside, however, told a different story. Anne Margaret's blood alcohol level, her BAC, was 0.415. And if you're sitting there thinking that means nothing to you and you have no idea, let's do some comparisons so you can see just how high her blood alcohol level was. In New Zealand, the legal blood alcohol limit for driving is 0.05, and that means 5 milligrams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood. Anne Margaret's was 415 milligrams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood. So her BAC was 8.3 times higher than the legal limit for driving in New Zealand. Now, in Canada and the US, the legal limit for driving is 0.8, so 8 milligrams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood. So her BAC was 5 times higher. Her blood alcohol level alone could have killed her. Heart failure, asphyxiation in her sleep, all these things could have very likely occurred. Her urine alcohol level was 0.510, so 510 milligrams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood. And this is obviously higher because blood is thicker than urine. It absorbs the alcohol quicker, but it just goes to show that it was an unbelievably high amount of alcohol in her system. This told forensic toxicologists that Anne Margaret likely finished consuming alcohol 30 minutes prior to her death. Couple that with the rigor mortis that sets in usually 4 to 6 hours after death, She would have died not too long after the girls left to go to dinner, meaning that the girls' timeline was tight but very much plausible. And also it meant that the girls left quite likely when she was having her last drink. Her toxicology report also found 0.7 milligrams of codeine per 100 milliliters of blood, acetaminophen at a rate of 3 milligrams per 100 milliliters of blood, and Benadryl in trace amounts. The codeine and acetaminophen combination is found together in Tylenol 3. Can I just say how well I'm saying that drug name? It makes me kind of feel like I'm Eminem's protege. Codeine and acetaminophen. Anyway, sorry. I was just like, yo, I said that real well. Tylenol 3 is a depressant that's used to treat mild and moderate pain. And when you combine that with the high blood alcohol level Ann Margaret had, her mental functioning was decreased to the point where it wasn't even functioning. There was no mental function. Regardless of her high tolerance to alcohol, this is a deadly combination, which is what seems to have happened in Ann Margaret's case. After the autopsy, they officially ruled Ann Margaret's death as an accidental drowning due to excessive alcohol intake. And that, my lovely listeners, concludes today's No. Don't be silly. This is a true crime podcast, and I ain't here to tell you about some accidental drowning, especially not in a mini-series called Deadly Daughters. So after the death of their mother, Caroline and Catherine moved in with their aunt Martha and carried on their path of drinking, drug-taking, and partying, which is quite ironic, is it not? But all of these behaviours were excused as young teenage girls dealing with the grief or the loss of their mother, and this continued up until about November of 2003, so about 11 months after their mother's death. And this is when a 21-year-old man, he's referred to as David, and I'm assuming this is his alias because of the protection laws I mentioned right at the start, and I couldn't find any other name given to him, so we'll just continue to call him David. 21-year-old David walked into Peel Regional Police Station and asked to speak to someone who was on the case of Anna Margaret's death. I'm not sure who he ended up speaking to, but David sat down with an officer and revealed a secret that he could no longer keep. That Ann Margaret's death was not an accident, but instead a cold and very calculated murder, and he knew who did it. Dun 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 dun. And come back for part two. No jokes. I'm being mean. I'm being very dramatic on these on this episode today. So he knows who did it, and he's gonna spill the beans. We're going to talk it through in a timeline order. So let's rewind the clock back a year. So November of 2002. Caroline was ready to be done with their mother. And she spoke to Catherine often about how they could be rid of her. Do they run away? Do they go and stay at someone else's house? Do they get emancipated? What do they do? And Caroline knew that there was a life insurance policy of $200,000 that had been taken out in Ann Margaret's name so that if anything happened to her, it would be equally divided between her three kids who would not be able to access it until they were 18 years old. So because Caroline knew of this life insurance policy, she thought, okay, well, why don't we kill Mother and get the money? Caroline believed that if they waited until she turned 18 to kill their mother, that would be far too suspicious as the motive, and they didn't want to spend another 2 years with their mother's incompetence anyway. Now, originally Catherine was not on board with this, but Caroline said she was going to do this with or without her sister, and eventually Catherine agreed and was going to see this through to the end with her sinister sister as they plotted the death of their mother for money. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Caroline and Catherine like to bitch about their mum to their friends, right? And complain about her and all that. Well, this didn't stop them talking to their friends about the idea that was in the forefront of their brains. The girls and their friends would talk about murdering Ann Margaret, but most of the time they spent talking about plans to do with the money after they got it. And this included a group trip overseas to Europe, and in particular, Amsterdam. I wonder why Amsterdam? Probably because of the drugs. Maybe. They also talked about how much weed and alcohol they could buy, since the girls would be receiving roughly $70,000 each. And then they came to this brilliant conclusion that they would invest in some land and start a marijuana farm. They're fucking geniuses, aren't they? Now, because they spent a lot of time talking about the plans with their money, a few of their friends saw this as like, I could just kill my mom. And so these plans were a fantasy and make-believe. But as Caroline and Catherine talked more about it, some of their friends realized just how serious they were. And two of their friends, Jay and Ashley, they actually came on board and offered to help them by being their alibi. Caroline also had a boyfriend at the time. His name was Donnie, but Donnie was kind of a good kid. He wasn't a big fan of Caroline's extracurricular activities like drinking, smoking, partying, skipping out on school and that kind of thing. So she decided not to get him involved and didn't tell him the plan. But Catherine, however, she had a boyfriend called Justin, and she was able to convince him to come on board with them. He bought them movie tickets and ripped them to make it look like they had been to the movies. Now, they didn't use going to the movies in their alibi, but it was kind of like a backup idea, because these girls are so smart and they think of everything. But Justin, the 15-year-old boyfriend, 15 years old, he also supplied the girls some Tylenol 3. Aspiring drug dealer? Maybe. So Jay, Ashley, and Justin, you know, these teenagers are all chipping in to help Caroline and Catherine kill their mum. And they were doing this because they did hear firsthand of how terrible their mum was with her alcoholism. But let's just remember that even though Anne Margaret drank a lot, never once did she lay her hand on those girls. She never abused them. She was just so far down in her own depression and exhaustion from being a single mum and dealing what sounded like two rebellious girls who, yes, they were sick of her shit and yes, they had a lot to deal with, but now she had to deal with their rebellious behavior, which again, that's normal teenage stuff, but she's just so exhausted and she's depressed as fuck. So much so that she just wanted to hide from the world. But she never abused her children. So yeah, she was so terrible, wasn't she? But over the next coming weeks, plans were made with a bit more gumption, a bit more drive. Using the internet and web chats, the girls were searching about common household accidents and how to stage them, how to set someone on fire. They downloaded a document about the physiological processes of drowning, effects of mixing different types of prescription and non-prescription drugs with alcohol, and then discussing their options with their friends. Jay recalled telling Caroline that drowning was one of the worst ways to die, and Caroline didn't think twice about it. On web chats with their friends, they just kept going on and on about how much they hated their mum and needed her dead. They started finalizing alibis and spoke more about plans. It was just so callous. And a tremendous amount of research went into this. They literally made a 14-step plan, which I'm going to get to. I'm going to read out in a minute. But 14-step plan to committing the perfect crime. It's not a fucking rehab recovery plan. It's a murder plan. Like, you can't get more premeditated than a murder plan. On January 2nd, 2003, there was a chat online between Jay and Caroline, and he said, quote, "How's it going with your mum?" end quote. And he wrote mum in like quotation marks. And Caroline replied saying, quote, "Drowning in tub, holding head while she's drunk, January 11th, end quote. So, Saturday, January 11th, 2003 rolled by. However, it didn't happen on this day because the girls were invited to a party on Sunday the 12th. And one of their friends said, "Well, you can't kill your mum today because you'll be preoccupied with the police tomorrow and then you can't come to my party." The girls thought, "Well, yeah, that's a fair point. Party, kill our mother. Party, kill our mother. Yeah, let's go to a party. We can push out killing our mother. That's fine. No biggie." And that's what they did. They thought they could survive one more week with their mum, and they pushed the date of her death out to the 18th of January. Fucking priorities. Am I right? Like, just a complete disregard for what they're about to do. The girls also wanted the murder to happen on a weekend where Bobby, their younger brother, was at his father's house so that he wasn't caught up in this. And Bobby would have only been around 5-6 years old at the time. So during the week leading up to the 18th, everything was set in place, and this is the 14-step plan that the girls made. Step 1. Pick a day. Step 2. Make a paper trail for the alibi. Make dinner reservations. Get movie tickets. Step 3. Get supplies. Tylenol 3 and alcohol. Step 4. Give mum the drink. Step 5. Draw a nice hot bath. Step 6. Get her in the tub and help her relax. Step 7. Wait till she's out of it and put on latex gloves. Step 8. Hold her head under the water for 4 minutes. Step 9. Check that she's definitely dead. Step 10. Go out and celebrate with friends. Come home and discover her dead. Step 11. Pick up the phone, practice crying, get into hysterics, and call 911. Step 12. This one pisses me off. Oh. Act like sad little girls. Play the victim. Step 13. Give alibi to the police. Step 14. Receive insurance money and live high as a hog. So there you have it, lovely listeners. There is your 14-step plan to committing the perfect crime. So, January 18th, 2003, Caroline and Catherine sat down with Anne Margaret to have some dinner, where they crushed Tylenol 3 and put it into her vodka lemonade mixed drink and also a few glasses of wine. All in all, Anne Margaret had taken a total of 6 Tylenol 3s. Now, Tylenol 3 should be 1 tablet every 4 hours, and she's had 6 in roughly an hour, hour and a half. And Margaret also drank a 1/5 of vodka, which at first, like, I didn't know what that actually was. I only heard it from that Eminem song. I drank a 1/5 of vodka. Dare me to drive? But it's actually a thing. So a 1/5 of vodka, if you didn't know like me, is 750 mils. Now in New Zealand, most bottles of vodka you can get are about 700 mils. You can get 1 liter ones as well, but most of them are 700 mils. So she pretty much drank just over a whole bottle of vodka, plus several glasses of wine, plus 6 Tylenol 3s. The girls then took her to the bathroom when she was barely conscious. And around this time, Ashley, who was meeting the girls at a nearby bus stop, she texted them asking, "How's it going?" Now, I'm not sure which sister she texted, but that sister replied, quote, "Bath time," end quote. And Ashley replied, quote, "Good luck. Don't forget the gloves," end quote. The sinister sisters got their mum into the bath and told Anne Margaret to roll into her stomach so that they could wash her back. But then they held her head under the water for 4 minutes. The girls had also learned on their research journey that when holding her head down, they should spread their fingers so it doesn't leave any bruising. Like, that's how deep they went into their research. The gloves, the 4 minutes, the spreading your fingers. Like, fuck, these girls made sure they dotted every I's and crossed every T's when it came to knowing about how to kill someone by drowning them. So it was time for step 9, check that she's definitely dead. And indeed, Anne Margaret had died. And after she was gone, the girls took her credit card, met Ashley at the bus stop, and went to Jack Astor's as part of their alibi. Caroline took the gloves with her so they were not left at the scene of the crime and disposed of them at the restaurant. Friends who were at Jack Astor's said that Caroline was actually kind of quiet and seemed upset, but Catherine seemed more excited and like giddy about what they had just done, even though she originally didn't want to be in it. At dinner, obviously these teenagers, they wanted to know, what was it like? How was it? Oh my gosh, you killed someone. Like, what was it like? And Caroline said, it wasn't as bad as she expected. It wasn't as bad as you expect. You've just physically held your mother's head under the water for 4 minutes. And it wasn't as bad. You know why it wasn't as bad, Caroline? Because she couldn't fucking fight back. Because you had drugged her. You piece of shit. Oh, sorry. She bright pisses me off. Like, fuck off, Caroline. The girls returned home around 10:30 p.m. and discovered, quote unquote, their mother in the tub. And originally Catherine was going to be the one to call 911. But when it came to do it, she said she didn't think she could cry. She just couldn't do it. So Caroline did it. And obviously we know what happened from there. And you know what? Fuck you, Catherine, you piece of shit. You can't even cry for your mother. She's just bitches. Absolute fucking bitches. I hate them. I'm sorry. I know that they had a lot to deal with, but this murder is just horrendous. It's fucking horrendous. At Anne Margaret's funeral, those who went were in absolute shock and were appalled at the little to no respect that the girls showed for their mother. They turned up with green and pink hair that was all spiked up and in very inappropriate clothing for a funeral and for your mother's funeral. They were also seen giggling and laughing while standing a few feet away from her open casket. Just little to no, well, not even little, just no respect, just fucking blatantly no respect at all. They both looked as if they'd rather be somewhere else. They had a few friends there to, quote unquote, support them laughing about the murder that they had committed. And because no one knew it was a murder, everyone thought it was an accidental drowning. They were like taking the piss, going, we've got away with this, and you are all there none the wiser. Apparently, a boy walked into the funeral and the girls were like flirting with him and like showing smiles. And it's like, the fuck? This is your mother's funeral. Put on a show for one day. Those that knew Anne Margaret were shocked because Anne Margaret only spoke highly of her two daughters, and here they were giggling about the whole ordeal. Now, I get people grieve differently, but the funeral goers more or less brushed off their behavior and, you know, excused it as grieving daughters. You know, they've dyed their hair and they're being inappropriate because they've just lost their mum. The poor things. Oh, they've just lost their mum. And I mean, fair enough. Like I said, everyone does grieve in their own way and you don't know how you're going to react in this situation. You might go and dye your hair and you might be very uncomfortable with the whole situation. And so all you might do is laugh. People do laugh at funerals, and this is more or less when you are remembering good times with a person or a memory comes up that makes you laugh. But there's a big difference between laughing at an old memory and taking the piss laughing, you know? So as mentioned before, after the funeral, the girls moved in with their Aunt Martha, but Walter, remember him, their biological father, he moved into Anne Margaret's townhouse and took the girls back with him. Now, Walter was not Anne Margaret, and when the girls thought that they didn't have any freedom with Anne Margaret because of her mental health issues and her alcoholism, they were about to find out what having no freedom is really like, because Walter had rules. There would be no drinking, no drug taking, no parties, no spending sprees. The girls had to produce receipts for everything that they purchased. They had to go to school and they had to pull their grades up. So they thought that they had no freedom and they wanted separation from Anne Margaret. They were allowed to drink. Well, I don't know if she would allow them to, but they went out drinking. They went out to parties. They did what teenagers want to do. But then they killed her. And so now they have to deal with Walter, who has rules. And he set curfews and set dinner times, which obviously they ignored and were like, what the fuck? Piss off. And it got to the point where even Walter could no longer control his daughters. That's how off the rails they were. So he sent them back to be with their Aunt Martha, and she ended up taking legal guardianship of Caroline and Catherine. She was a lot more relaxed and showed so much sympathy for the two girls. She gave them money when they asked for it, but they just used this on drugs and alcohol and continued down the dark path, which ironically is the reason they killed their mother, right? Because she was on a dark path by drinking all the time. And what are they doing? They're now drinking all the time. Isn't that a little hypocritical, maybe? After some time went by, Ashley, their friend who met them at the bus stop, she was starting to have panic attack after panic attack, because if Caroline and Catherine ever got caught for what they did, Ashley knew she would be charged as an accomplice and the police would know that she lied about their alibi. It got so bad that she nearly turned the girls in. So her conscience set in far too late. Donnie, Caroline's boyfriend. He became suspicious about the whole thing, and Caroline ended up confessing to him what had happened. He promptly broke up with her, and this sent Caroline into a depression spiral. Doesn't that sound familiar? Caroline, isn't that the reason that you killed your mother? Because she was so depressed, because her heart had been broken and stomped on and abused, and she was depressed after the fact, so she was drinking. And now, Caroline, your boyfriend's broken up with you because you're a murderer? You poor little thing. But yes, she went into a depression spiral. She started drinking more, taking more drugs. And Catherine, I mean, she was just joining in the escapades because of all this freedom that she now had. They would go out to random people's houses for parties, drink and get so intoxicated that they would speak casually about the murder to strangers. And it all came crashing down on them when they revealed what they did to one person who was so disturbed by what he heard, he went to the police. Which brings us back to November of 2003 when David went to the police and told them what he had heard. So after David revealed to the police that the girls had admitted to killing Anne Margaret, investigators reopened and looked at her file. They saw it was ruled as an accidental drowning due to excessive alcohol intake and that there was no suspicion of foul play. Because of this, it was too hard to take David's word alone. They needed a cause for a warrant and a reason to even speak to the girls again about the matter. But police wanted to entertain what David was saying and they referred to this case as the Bathtub Girls murder. David was concerned about Caroline's drug use and she had spoken to him about how she was suicidal at the time and she said to him, quote, "I killed her. I murdered her. Someone was going to die that night, either me or her," end quote. But then she went on to boast about how they tricked the police into believing it was an accident and how they were just getting away with it. Police got David onto a wire and they trained him on how to breach the subject with the girls. They also put a hidden camera in his car. And after 2 months, he had managed to get both of the girls talking and confessing to the crime again, with police listening to every word. They'd go into discussion about how they had help from their friends. They'd talk on the internet, the multiple scenarios, staging household accidents, every piece of research they put in. They would just blab. They need to learn to shut up. David asked Caroline if she was ever going to turn herself into the police, and she said she wouldn't because it would destroy her life and many others around her, and she worried about Bobby and who would look after him if she went to prison. Caroline said that once she turned 18, she would take legal guardianship of Catherine, who would not be far off turning 18 herself, but also of Bobby. Now, yes, this could be her being a good big sister. I see this as, was she trying to get Bobby's share of the inheritance? You know, possibly manipulating the system somehow to get his share of the inheritance given to her for his best interest? I don't know. There's just something a bit fishy about that. And her actions were saying otherwise. She was spending money she didn't have. She was drinking. She was taking drugs. Not someone who was going to do a complete 180 on her 18th birthday and get clean, be financially stable to look after a 7, 8, 9-year-old until he's 18. It's just delusional. She's a delusional, entitled, murderous bitch. That's what she is. January 21st, 2004, just over a year since their mother's murder, Peel Regional Police picked up Caroline and Catherine from their Aunt Martha's house. Police got warrants to search the house and for all of the electronics, cell phones, computers, everything. They picked the girls up at around 7 a.m. They were both still in their pajamas. Police told the girls they could get changed and Caroline did, but Catherine said, "No, I'd rather not." The girls were taken separately to the same police station and interviewed separately until 4 p.m. that day. Caroline confessed at 1 p.m., but not to its entirety. She said that Catherine had nothing to do with it and she didn't know anything was happening until after the fact that it wasn't her. So she was taking the fall, and Caroline also said that the motive was definitely not about the money, even though it was in her 14-step plan. But anyway, what do I know? But she said it was for more independence and freedom, Which, okay, I get it. Every teenager feels like they want that. But they were going out anyways. They were drinking and taking drugs. Like, how much more freedom would a teenager want? That is the teenage dream, right? To be able to go out and do whatever you want without having to deal with your parents. Because they were doing that anyway. Because Anne Margaret was too depressed to say anything. And she was at work and she was trying to do this and trying to do that. And then when she lost her job, she just collapse because she's a human. But to live this free life, Caroline, you are going to need money. So don't sit there and tell me it wasn't about the money, because it was. If you want to live a free life and have all the alcohol and drugs that you want, you're going to need money. Who has money? Oh, there's $70,000 sitting there with your name on it in your mother's life insurance policy. Don't fucking sit there and tell me it wasn't about the money. I'm so sorry that I'm so angry in this episode. I just can't. I'm absolutely frothing. But Caroline also said that Anne Margaret was slowly killing herself, so she just wanted to put her mother out of her misery. All right, yeah, okay. Maybe Anne Margaret was going to drink herself to death, but you know what? That was Anne Margaret's decision to make, not yours. You do not have the right to play God and take someone else's life away. I don't buy that. That she wanted to put her mother out of her misery because she was drinking herself to death. I don't buy that, but that's my thought on that response. You don't have the right to take someone else's life. It's not your decision. Now, Catherine, on the other hand, she never said anything. She refused to cooperate, and she also asked for her lawyer. Now, I found this very interesting. In Canada, when you ask for a lawyer, the interrogation doesn't have to stop. Whereas like in the US and I believe in New Zealand, I'm not actually too sure, if you are being interviewed by police and you say, I want a lawyer, the interview has to stop. But in Canada, it doesn't. I thought that was quite interesting. Police then showed Catherine the audio from David's wire and the footage of the hidden camera about her confessing, and she still adamantly denied the whole thing. After the interviews, the two girls were placed together. They were told that anything they said would still be recorded. They spoke to each other in Polish. I don't know if they knew this, but there are translators in Canada. Okay, there are Polish-speaking people in Canada. We'll find out what you said. Basically, Caroline was telling Catherine not to say anything. Don't fall for police tactics. We haven't done anything wrong. David fell for our silly joke. Like, this is all it is, just a whole big joke. So Caroline is not telling Catherine that she's already confessed and that she's going to take the fall for it. Which, okay, I get it, big sister, but I don't like them. I think they're just entitled little bitches, both of them. But after a full search of their electronics, it was very clear that both girls were very much involved. Caroline a bit more, but Catherine was definitely involved. They were both charged with the murder of Anne Margaret. In April of 2004, they posted bail and were released awaiting their trial. Ashley, Jay, Justin, and Donnie were also picked up by police and taken in for questioning. Jay was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, and he was also released on bail. Ashley agreed to testify against the sisters, so she was not charged for anything. Justin, Catherine's boyfriend, he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder and as an accomplice for supplying the drugs. He was sentenced to 18 months in prison, and only served four fucking months for giving the girls the loaded gun. He couldn't even do his full 18-month sentence. Like, all right, yes, okay, he didn't kill Anne Margaret, but he gave them the Tylenol 3. He's 15. Where the hell is he getting Tylenol 3 from? Like, that's a prescription-controlled drug. You have to get that, like, given to you by a doctor. So he's stealing that from somewhere, or he's buying it from someone who's stolen it. That's, like I said, aspiring drug dealer right there. And he got 4 months. Now, the trial for Caroline and Catherine took place in November of 2005. So they were out on bail for like a year and a half waiting. And their trial took 8 weeks in total. Now, during the trial, it's reported that the girls loved the attention they were receiving. They were caught snickering and giggling when the prosecution was covering the autopsy of their mother. And the Crown prosecution made the case that with how calculated and premeditated and callous these girls were, how they showed zero remorse through this whole ordeal, the interrogations, the interviews, the funeral, and now at their trial, the prosecution wanted these girls to receive a life sentence plus 10 years with no possibility of parole. And in December of 2005, both Caroline and Catherine were found guilty for the murder of Anne Margaret. And now, lovely listeners, are you ready for the most infuriating part of this whole episode? Because of the Canadian Youth Justice Act, which protects all types of youth offenders, even the monstrous murderous types, Caroline and Catherine received 10 years each. That's it. 10 years each for the murder. The premeditated, calculated, cold-blooded murder of their mother. 10 years. Did they stay in prison for 10 years? Of course they fucking didn't. They were more or less model inmates, and Caroline was released into a halfway house after serving 4 years. 4 years for killing her mother. Catherine, the youngest, who didn't originally want to be on board with this plan, who then convinced her boyfriend to give her the drugs, who then didn't confess to the crime even when being shown a video of her confessing to the crime, she served 6 years in prison. And they believed that Catherine needed to spend more time in prison for rehabilitation purposes. Like, are you fucking serious? What a joke! Caroline, who confessed and probably did like 70% of the killing, got less time? And upon her release, Caroline's therapist said that she is still extraordinarily manipulative and has the same state of mind since before the murder. And she's rehabilitated and released? I don't particularly think so, and especially if a therapist said that she is still problematic. After her release, Caroline went on to study, and she excelled, and she became an engineer. She's got a really good fucking job. After Catherine was released, I'm not sure what she did straight away, but the most recent reports is that she's married with 2 children, and she's pursuing a career as a lawyer. A lawyer. And both girls reportedly still live in the Ontario area. On the terms of their release, the only thing that these 2 girls couldn't do, and they were both released around the age of 20, so think back to when you were 20, they were told they were allowed to go as long as they didn't drink or smoke again. You're telling 2 20-year-old girls who have only been in prison for 4 to 6 years for the murder of their mother that they're not allowed to drink and smoke? Canada, are you okay? Y'all are so trusting. Like, what the fuck? And now they're, like, having amazing lives. They've got really good lives. They've got really good jobs. One's married with kids. The other one's an engineer. Like, what the hell? Okay, so yes, they are contributing members of society, and they've not been in trouble with the law since, and we know this because if they were in trouble with the law, we would know about it as they're no longer minors. But 4 and 6 years for the very calculated, premeditated murder of their mother? I'm just shocked. I can't make it make sense in my head. And due to the Canadian Youth Protection Act that we spoke about at the start, this means that the girls don't ever have to disclaim what they did to anyone. Not their employers, not their spouses, not their neighbours, not to anyone. Their names can't be published anywhere in Canada regarding the crime on any kind of news outlet or journalism. And if someone is caught doing that, they'll get slapped with a fine and could spend up to 2 years in prison. And that's half the sentence that Caroline did for murder. If you live in the Ontario area, these could be your neighbours and you wouldn't even know. Now, there are rumours that Anne Margaret's boyfriend that she had at the time of the death, the one that she wanted to marry but was kind of rushing it, there are rumours that he visits her grave with flowers, but like no one really knows. There just seems to be flowers on her grave all the time. But This was super interesting. On Anne Margaret's Find a Grave webpage, there were flowers left by an anonymous account, and there was a message left with the flowers, and it says, quote, "I know you miss me," end quote. Which, first off, that's kind of creepy as hell. I know you miss me. Two, was it left by the boyfriend or one of her murderous daughters? Or was Google Translate letting the people of Poland down? And it was from a relative who said something nice in Polish and Google translated it very, very poorly. Who knows? Who knows? But I thought that was quite interesting. And I really want to know who left those flowers and sent that note. In 2011, a movie was released about the crime, and it's called Perfect Sisters, starring Abigail Breslin and Georgie Henley. I haven't been able to watch it yet, but it got a 5 out of 10 rating on IMDb and rated 25% on Rotten Tomatoes. All the reviews said that it's like super overdramatized, it's not accurate, it's a pretty shit movie, but it shows more or less what happened. The most famous book about this case is called The Class Project, How to Kill a Mother by Bob Mitchell. He used the aliases Linda Anderson for Anne Margaret and Sandra and Beth for the two girls. And that is what is commonly used in reporting and other podcasts I listen to on this case. But like I said at the start, I feel like these girls need to be called out because it's all whack. Their sentence was shit. The fact that they've had the opportunity to do so well in life is ridiculous. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm glad they haven't gone and murdered someone else. Well done, you're like the fucking majority of society. But unlike the majority of society, they've already committed a murder and have taken someone else's life away. And this wasn't like spur of the moment. This wasn't a heated argument that turned physical, which turned deadly. This was calculated. A 14 fucking step plan was created. Now, I don't think they should have been given a life sentence because of their age, but I do believe they should have spent a substantial amount of time behind bars, to be honest. I think 20 to 25 years. In all, if I'm being honest, I think they should have spent 20 to 25 years for this crime. They have taken someone else's life away, their mother's life away, and they've been able to live their lives protected with a slap on the wrist. Now, yes, like I said, Anne Margaret might have been drinking herself to death, but you know what? That would have been her decision. And you never know. Bobby, her son, might have been the one to help her change her life around. He was only 5-6 years old and now he's lost his mother, and we know that his father, Doug, is an asshole and he's been left with him. And his mum's gone and he might have been the one to help her get clean. But she never had the chance to find that out. And yes, of course, help was offered to her and she was too proud to take it. It was not up to them to decide whether Anne Margaret lived or died. Anne Margaret didn't even get to meet her grandchildren. And what about those grandchildren when they grow up and they see their friends have grandparents and they go, where's my nana? What happened to my nana? Do you think Catherine's going to sit there and tell her children that, oh yeah, sorry kids, nana's not here because I fucking murdered her when I was 15 years old. Of course not. Of course she isn't. I'm so sorry that I've been so angry. I think this is the most I've ever sworn in an episode and I'm so, so sorry. This case is really hitting home for me, and I think it's because I'm a single mum. When my daughter was born, I was at university studying to get my degree full-time. I was studying full-time as well as working 3 part-time jobs, which was practically full-time on top of that, but at unsociable hours. And so I know how exhausting it is. And yes, even though I didn't become an alcoholic, I would have a drink every now and again. It'd be, you know, my nights off or something like that. And, you know, I worry just about every day that when my daughter's a teenager and understands the world a bit more, that she's going to resent me. And I'm just trying my best to not let that happen. But it's something I have to keep in mind and worry about every day. And this is why Anne Margaret's story is hitting so close to me and why I'm so angry about the way that her daughters did this behind her back. They planned her murder while she's there, depressed, abused, broken, she's fucking broken and her daughters are complaining they don't have a pool in their fucking garden. It's just, it's awful. It's so sad. But yeah, that's, I'm really sorry about my language. Mum, don't listen to this episode. Dad, please do not listen to this episode. But as always, I want to know what you think about their sentence. Is it, slide on into my DMs and let's chat about it. You can find me on Facebook or Instagram at Coffee and Crime Podcast. Let me know. Goldilocks situation. Is it too short, too long, just right? What do you guys think? But that, my lovely listeners, is the story of Anne Margaret Lebenstein, who was so callously murdered by her two daughters, Caroline and Catherine Carubin. And that concludes part three of our Deadly Daughters series. Now, before I wrap up, if you're still here, like I said at the beginning, we are going to play a little game to see if you can guess who next week's Deadly Daughter is going to be. So, you ready? Each of the cases that I've covered in this little series, there's an aspect from each that is in next week's case, and I'm going to give you the clues. In the Kathy family murder episode, the aspect that is similar is the motive. In the murder of Xu Yi Zhang, the similar aspect is the online activity of the perpetrator. And in this week's episode, the murder of Anne Margaret Lebenstein Carubin, the similar aspect is the location. So you may need to listen to part one and part two to understand those clues, but if you have already, thank you, thank you. I really do appreciate it. So if you think that you figured it out, flick me a message on Instagram or Facebook. Again, that's Coffee and Crime Podcast. If you get it right, you will automatically get 5 entries into the upcoming giveaway when Coffee and Crime hits 1,000 followers. So is that some incentive for you? I would love to see what you guys think. I mean, to be honest, some people have already guessed it or they've suggested for me to do it. And so I'm not going to reveal that yet unless you've said that you've got it from the clues. So if you've messaged me saying, do this person, and you got it right, you now need to re-message me and be like, do this person because of the clues. And you will get 5 entries into the upcoming giveaway. Also, next week, you have to tune in next week because, oh my God, I'm so excited. I'm going to be joined by a very, very special guest for next week's episode. And guys, I'm freaking the F out because this is going to sound so silly, but it's going to be like meeting a low-key celebrity for me. So I'm freaking out because we're hosting the episode together and I'm so excited. And next week is just going to be a phenomenal episode. So please, please, please tune in. But until next time, until we get to that very exciting episode, I want you all to be safe, be good, be better, and all that cheesy crap. And I will catch you guys next week for the deadliest daughter of them all, right here at Coffee and Crime. Bye!